it's what shall we call it? There's a leap there. There's an interval to be crossed. There's a new level of consciousness. It has to do with being awake. It has to do with awakening. And it has to be a conscious choice. It's not just the conditioning of the shoulds of religion. It is the real awakening of that in us which can see. The real awakening of Ruh begins here. And frankly, most of the work of Tasawwuf, of Sufism and Tariqa, begins at this level. And this level also applies to all the other levels and makes the work of all the earlier levels easier, more productive, more effective. But this is the awakening of the Ruh through which we can see and witness ourselves by first establishing a state of presence. Presence, which I would equate with mindfulness in Buddhist teaching, as a prerequisite, even before remembrance of God, that we need to literally be here. And that's also why we walk this circle so many times. Even though we're in this beautiful setting with all of these spiritual reminders around ourselves, I hope you experienced becoming more and more awake in that process by having some real relationship with your body, with your heart, with the names of God, and also with an expanded awareness encompassing the whole group. These were all intentional reminders to help sort of stretch, develop our being in these different dimensions, and to awaken and develop your own very inner substance. Because a human being has an inner substance which needs to be cultivated. Ordinary education doesn't do this. Sufi education develops the inner substance, the true inner divine attributes of the human being. Among them, a healthy will, a healthy sense of sacrifice, a capacity for self-transcendence, which is also having a sense of humor about oneself, a freedom from my own self-manifestations, which can only come when, by the grace of God, it is awakened in me. Our own will is not enough to awaken us and keep us awake, but our own will is enough to begin to remove some of the obstacles to our awakening. So that when we say, La ilaha illallah, La ilaha, there are no gods. In other words, let go of all of our idols in order to be empty enough that illallah, the presence of God, might come. I don't have control over the presence of God. I don't have control over the power of forgiveness or of wisdom or even of generosity or of any of these things. But I can begin to remove some veils. I can begin to remove some obstacles by not justifying my negativity, by not reinforcing my resentments, by not creating conditions in my life that buttress the distracted state. We polish our hearts. This is our work. This is what we can do. It's a humble work. And sometimes it takes the form of doing practices, of the forms of worship that the tradition offers us, of fasting, which also removes veils from the heart and sensitizes the heart, of night vigil. It's also been a very important practice in Sufism. The Prophet in the Quran says one of the greatest ways of controlling the nafs is getting up in the middle of the night and praying. So we learn to cultivate this healthy discipline, healthy will, self-sacrifice, to keep polishing the heart, to keep opening the space, cleaning our own house, so that the wisdom, the beauty, the grace of God can enter this house. This is expressed beautifully by Mevlana when he says, the whole business of religion is to open a window in the heart that the beauty of the beloved might shine through that window. And through that, we ourselves are beautified. So he says, don't thrust your axe on every thicket. It's a bit like, don't try necessarily to crush every desire, every aspect of your own humanity. It's a waste of time. You've got this axe. At least open a window in your heart. At least do that. That you might have some relationship with the divine and keep that relationship continually. Excuse me. I'm going to accelerate through the stages, but the stage four is so much of the Tarika work. Sustaining presence and remembrance, polishing the heart, removing the obstacles of envy, resentment, and pride. Ultimately, this begins to lead us to experiences of fana, of what's called annihilation. I said earlier, we never totally annihilate the self. Sometimes the self disappears before the face of God, the way the stars disappear in the sunlight. But that doesn't mean they're gone. But experiences of fana, experiences of a kind of selflessness, a kind of relative selflessness that begin to come at this stage. I'll just touch on them briefly. Maybe you have had experiences where you realized, you felt, you knew that you weren't doing what you were doing. This is called the annihilation of actions. In the Quran, it's represented esoterically by the verse that says to Muhammad, Muhammad, you did not throw when you threw, but Allah threw through you. And that refers to a moment in a battle when the early Muslim community was in danger of being annihilated in a tangible sense. And they were losing the battle. They were greatly outnumbered. And Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him, who was on the front lines, empty-handed, picks up a fistful of gravel and throws it at this massive army. And this is true, and literally turned the battle with that one act. And Allah revealed in the Quran the next day, thou didst not throw when thou threwest. So the annihilation of actions is the beginning of seeing that our actions, which we think are our own, we think, you know, in our self-centered universe, we think, we imagine we're in control despite all the evidence that has accumulated. But we have these moments of seeing synchronicities, grace, creativity. We see that we are not quite the author of our actions the way maybe we imagined we were. And there's a further fana, which is called the fana of qualities. When we come to realize that even the qualities that we thought were ours, our strength, our willpower, our patience, we come to see that, in fact, these are qualities lent to us by a divine source, that we depend on Allah for these qualities, and that we learn, in a sense, to invoke them with open hands to say, my God, I am weak. I am, as my brother Ahmed Tijani says, and I say exactly the same, I am a helpless, hopeless human being. I need your help, Allah. And finally, there's the annihilation of essence. We think, I mean, the mystic thinks finally that even that there's an essence there that is me. One day, too, even that may be taken away. So it's at this fourth maqam that, and sometimes too at a certain age in people's lives, on the path, it's typically in the 40s when these experiences of fana start coming predictably or frequently. This leading us to the state of union, the fifth maqam, the state of oneness with God, which in some traditions would be considered the end of it all, the realization, nirvana. In some spiritual models, you sort of launch your rocket to the infinite, and there it goes, and then you reach unity, and that's it. You're in unity, and you're gone. And you may never come back. But in Sufism, one of my teachers said, there's some egoism in unity. There's still a little egoism in that experience of unity. Yes, it's oneness with God, but why is it not considered the highest state on this journey? It's a beautiful, blissful state. By the way, a little tip to you, to those who read the Mathnawi, the Mesnevi of Jalaluddin Rumi. It's 6 books. Some of the great masters have written works that have 6 books. Some have written about 7 valleys, but some have written 6 books. Although Rumi never articulated this, I believe if you look closely, you will see that these 6 books correspond to the first 6 maqams, these first 6 levels of self. And the 7th level needs no book. So in the 5th book of the Mesnevi is where you're going to find a lot of references to the completed human being, the unity with the Sheikh, the unity and the bliss of being in divine unity in the 5th book. If it's not completely that way, otherwise it'd be a very boring book. But it predominates, and you can get clues to these maqams by approaching the Mesnevi in this way. So the stage of unity, is such a gift, it's such beauty, which we come to know that it is all nothing but the unfolding of being. It is just, in every moment, the unfolding of being. This whole existence. And the being is merciful, and awesomely generous, and beautiful. And we think we know it in that unity. But the truth is, we don't know it well enough yet. Do, re, mi, fa. Soul is 5 in the musical scale. Soul is the sun. Soul is our soul. Unity. Stage 6, la. God help you from la, which means no. Years ago, a Sufi teacher told me, everything that Jesus lived outwardly, we must live inwardly. The story of Jesus, whether or not it has any historical value, is a allegory also for the soul's journey. If you begin to read book 6 of the Mesnevi, you think, book 6, getting really high, book 5 was really good. You know, we were really high in book 5. Book 6, war. This whole existence is at war. Don't ever expect anything different in this world, because every element is at war. This is the nature of this level of existence. It's frightening to read the opening lines, the opening pages and chapters of Book 6, because you are faced with something terrible. Just as Jesus was faced with his crucifixion, stage 6 is a stage of crucifixion. Its divine name is Qayyum, which is like the pole of reality that runs through all levels of existence, which we must know, which we must find. But what begins to happen at stage 6 is that after all the beauty and mercy of stage 5, the bliss with its subtle egoism, because after all, ha, I'm in union, or union is. Stage 6, you may lose everything you had. You may lose everything you loved. You may find yourself standing alone, facing terrible suffering. Only then can you say, La ilaha illallah. No, this is not God. No, that's not God. My bliss is not God. My happiness, even my union, is not. But it's further, La ilaha illallah. We learn through this suffering, through this crucifixion, where we are anchored, where the divine reality is centered. And we learn it through a heart that has been able to experience remembrance through the greatest expansion and the greatest contraction, and to know there's no difference. There is no difference. That is the God we want to know. And the only way to know it is to take the whole course. To finish the course. Sehri Suluk. This is why the teachers talk. They don't talk about it a lot, actually. But there is the recognition that there is a journey, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. The end is not really an end, of course. The end is just a beginning. It's the end of something, but it's not the end of it. It's the end of something. And then, as a sort of final goal, stage 7. First of all, let me go back a little bit, because I neglected to mention the names at the earlier levels. Remember, La ilaha illallah was one. Allah was the second stage of the nafs. Hu, the divine presence, the pronoun of divine presence, was stage 3. Stage 4, haq, truth, reality. Let me mention something that I've wanted to mention about stage 4, and that is that the dervish learns to see with two eyes, two very different eyes. One is the eye of wahdat, the eye of oneness, of unique oneness. And we look out at this world. They have a phrase, in Turkish, it's living in wahdat, meaning everything I see out here, it's God. I have no complaints. I do have complaints, but in wahdat, I would not have complaints. If I were in that state and I look out, I would remind myself that everything out there is by arrangement brought to you by Allah. There's no fault finding allowed. If there's something you'd like to make better, fine. Please go ahead. Make any improvements you like. That's what you're here for. But no complaints, please. and especially no resentment. So that's the eye of Wahdat. To see everything out there, you have no criticism of it. And as Shams of Tabriz said, you have a friend, you have a helper. And your helper, if there were a wall as high as the universe and as wide as the horizon in front of you, your friend would kick that wall out of your way for you, and has done so many times before. But your friend asks one thing for his friendship, and that is that you greet every circumstance of your life as if it's your greatest happiness. To ensure his help, this is how you ensure it. That's how it's done. So with the eye of Wahdat, this is what we see outside. But there's another eye, the eye of Furqan, the eye of Farq, the eye of noticing differences of better and worse, and better and best, of the eye of discernment, the eye of discrimination. And we also use that eye. But where do we turn that eye? We turn it to ourselves. And what allows us to turn it to ourselves is our knowing already that we are loved, that we are in this universe created by a merciful God. And it's that that allows us to be a little bit more stringent with ourselves. So if stringency is required on this path, it is for ourselves, not for others. Be gentle with people. Be stringent with yourself. So you have these two eyes that are always looking, the eye of Farq, the eye of Wahdat. Everything out there, it's perfect. Inside, there's lots of problems inside. My attitude may not be right. My submission may be half-hearted, etc., etc. Put these two eyes together, and you then have the vision of Tawheed. Tawheed is not oneness. Tawheed is oneness plus. So you have these, Tawheed means, yes, the unity of it all. But we live the unity by being thankful for existence, objective with ourselves, merciful towards others, stringent with ourselves, which is usually the opposite of, you know, I don't need to go into that. So at stage four, Haq is the name, Haq, which means truth, reality. And it's also has the meaning of rights. What are the rights? Give everything its own right, what it has a right to. Stage five is stage of unity. The name is Hai, life. And where we become one with the flow of life. And life is not this material existence. This, after all, we take life out of our bodies and we become rotting corpses. Life is eternal. Life is a divine attribute. To become unified with Hai, with that life, is, yes, to die before you die, to enter eternal life, to enter the after-death state while still alive, and to be free. So that's Hai. Stage six was Qayyum. Qayyum, the eternally self-subsisting, which you can envision as a pole running through all levels of reality, and that which you hold to, like the rope of God, through the crucifixion of stage six. And stage seven, the perfected self, a nafs, a lot of names for it, as-Sufiya, al-Kamila, etc. I don't know what to say. In fact, even Rumi didn't write a book about it. Two names. Well, one to be very careful with, in fact, not to use without permission of your sheikh, and that is Qahar. Qahar, it's power beyond power. It is the total power of God, which is the only power that exists. But put that aside and take instead the name Yawadud, the loving. And use that anytime you like. Yawadud. Yawadud. And Wadud, there's all kinds of love in this universe. There's the Rahma, the Rahman, which is showering upon all of us all the time. Unconditional, indiscriminate. It showers upon believer, unbeliever. It showers upon every nation, every people, every religion. And there's the Rahim, which is the mercy we know when we orient ourselves to God and we get a special relationship. And then there's the Hub, which is love, but it's love that can come and go. And in fact, you know, it's interesting, in the Quran, we have this notion that God loves everything all the time, but how many places in the Quran does it say, God does not love the corrupt, God does not love the unjust, which we can understand to mean that we can cut ourselves off from a certain relationship with the divine. We will always be sustained. There's always, God will never leave us. We will always have the Rahman, the compassion of God. But if we want to be beloved by God, we need to be worthy of that. And the Wadud is the name of God that is the ever-increasing love of God for the one who has deserved that love. And it's a love that keeps providing for your needs in ways that you never imagined. And this is a promise in the Quran, and I could read scores of these promises in the Quran, but let me read you one. This is in Surah 65, ayats 2-3. For the one who sustains consciousness of God, God always prepares a way of emergence. It's beautiful. By the way, incidentally, never mind. Well, yes, incidentally, it comes in the chapter on divorce. It's a very merciful thing. It's really, it's the second and third verses in the chapter on divorce, I believe. For the one who sustains consciousness of God, he always prepares a way of emergence. But understand this in the most elevated, sublime sense. And he provides in ways one could never imagine. And anyone who puts trust in God will find that God is sufficient. Period. For God will surely accomplish his purpose. Truly, God has appointed for all things an appropriate measure. Now, on the very first night, we considered, I read some Rumi, and I forgot actually, it's a very important poem that I had wanted to end the whole evening with. Our subject was surrender. And, you know, Rumi is sometimes thought of as a wild man and a crazy man. And in one passage, he even says, I've tried sane thinking. Now I will make myself insane. You know. Now, we in America, with our love of rebelliousness and bohemianism and eccentricity and all of that, at least my generation, we project our own sad story on that. But listen, what kind of insanity is Mevlana Jalaluddin recommending to us? What kind of insanity? What kind of intoxication and what kind of ecstasy is he calling for? Conventional opinion is the ruin of our souls. Something borrowed, which we mistake as our own. Ignorance is better than this. Clutch at madness instead. Always run from what seems to benefit yourself. Sip the poison and spill the water of life. Revile those who flatter you. Lend both interest and principal to the poor. Let security go and be at home amidst danger. Leave your good name behind and accept disgrace. I have lived with cautious thinking. Now I will make myself mad. So that is Rumi's intoxication. As I think you realize, it is not the intoxication of the self. Now, I want to read you a short list of what I call attributes of a spiritually mature human being. This is from a chapter called Enlightenment and Completion in the book The Knowing Heart. And really, after looking at, you know, this crazy world of spirituality and this crazy world of spiritual teachers, which has got to be one of the most dangerous professions in the world, to be honest, I had to say, well, let's make an assessment here. What sort of criteria should we expect of this education? Really, what are the parameters? What do we hope to attain? Because all too often, as I said, beware of those who have had a glimpse, you know, a moment's glimpse of something and want to be teachers. So, first of all, what we can hope for, self-knowledge, the degree to which we know ourselves, our weaknesses, limitations, characteristics, and motivations. Any spiritual seeker, and of course, any leader or teacher, should have this kind of self-knowledge. Self-control, the ability to guide and transcend the promptings of the individual self. Objective knowledge, a knowledge that is in accord with reality, a useful knowledge about the practical needs of life. Inner wisdom, the ability to access guidance and meaning from within. Being, the capacity to remain in a state of presence. Selfless love, the love for God and His creations without selfish motives. Sustaining the divine perspective, the ability to always see events and people from the highest perspective and to not slip into egoistic judgment and opinion. And finally, divine intimacy, one's awareness of one's connection to the divine source. So, it's 4:30. Thank you for your attention. your open hearts, your listening. I wish we had had time for questions, but we walked and listened instead. And I wish we had time for more of Latif's music, but we're going to have a beautiful sampling of that tonight, inshallah. So, salam alaikum.